Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories. Good morning. Welcome. This, as you just heard a recorded version of me say, is Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. I'm Jesse. Today's show is produced on the unceded ancestral territory of the Hunkaminam and Squamish-speaking peoples who have lived here since time immemorial and whose lands were never formally, legally, officially given away, traded, or ceded in any way. And so we live here on occupied lands. Today on the show, we have two longer form pieces for you. We're going to hear an expansion of the Walker's Caucus piece that Danny did. We're going to hear a full interview with David Brunn. If you were listening to Speak Up yesterday morning, you would have heard the shortened, condensed news-style version of that, and so we'll dive a little bit further in depth. And also a new edit of a piece you may have heard on previous episodes of Speak Up a couple weeks ago, my conversation with Dr. Jean Polfus about caribou recovery strategies and how incorporating Indigenous language and knowledge and perspectives can help make that better and more effective. So we're going to get all of that, maybe a song or two to transition in between, but we are going to start with the talking right away. This is Danny's conversation with David Brunn.
This is Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. The Burnaby Walkers Caucus is a local citizens group dedicated to improving walkability for all in their community. One of the ways they do this is through blind-led community walks throughout the Lower Mainland. The goal of these walks, which encourage the attendance of government officials and members of the community, is to show the gaps in safety and accessibility within pedestrian infrastructure, specifically around crosswalks and intersections. CJSF was recently invited to one of these community walks in North Vancouver, which was hosted by David Brunn and his guide dog Nadia. After the walk, we were able to sit down for a conversation with David Brunn and speak on the work he's done with these blind-led community walks, as well as the ways that pedestrian infrastructure needs to be improved to address the safety and accessibility concerns of blind people. Please take a listen. I think the first question I wanted to ask you about it is just how you got involved in the first place with the Walkers Caucus and you know, leading these community walks.
Yeah, so back in November, December last year, Vic, working with two other people in the blind community that I know, Fraser and Karim, did a walk similar to what we did, but in Burnaby, and it was with one of the reporters from CBC Radio. And so I got the opportunity to listen to it, and I know Fraser pretty well, so I asked him about it, and he said, you know, that Vic was looking for individuals to lead walks in their communities. And I thought it was such a good idea that I contacted Vic. We started chatting. And next thing I knew, he was lighting me up for a walk. So pretty happy with how it all worked out.
How many walks have you led at this point?
Yeah, so I've now led 5 walks. So I've led walks with the first one was with Herman Ma, who's a counselor in the District of North Vancouver. Then Jessica McIlroy, who is a counselor for the City of North Vancouver. And then Tony Valente, who is also a counselor for the City of North Vancouver. A walk with Susie Chant, who is the MLA for Seymour North Vancouver. And at the time, she was also the parliamentary secretary for accessibility. Hope she still is, but I haven't had a chance to see how that's all worked out after the election. And then the fifth walk was with Shervin Sharari, that you accompanied us on Saturday in North Vancouver.
Mm-hmm. You're local to North Vancouver in that case, then.
Yeah, I'm a North Shore person, living in the city of North Vancouver. But I also, in my early years, grew up in Vancouver. So I really know the Arbutus and Kitsilano area super well.
Yeah, when I was told the walk was happening in North Van, I also live in North Vancouver, so that was very convenient for me as well.
Yeah, it's always great to have that sort of background knowledge when you're going to an area.
Mm-hmm. Since, you know, you know so much, I guess, of like the walking infrastructure around not just North Vancouver, but you said like Arbutus and other parts of Vancouver proper. Are there any parts of the Lower Mainland that you look at and think, you know, oh, that's a good example of walking infrastructure or pedestrian infrastructure? Or is kind of most of it in need of rethinking?
Yeah. That's a really good question. And in regard to where we are with accessible intersections and so forth, I think in a lot of ways we're where we were 30 years ago when curb cutaways first started happening. And, you know, it took a long time for that to be sort of rolled out and for people to realize the importance of having those curb cutaways for people using wheelchairs, and also all the added benefits that came out of that for young families and strollers and all of that. So right now with accessible intersections, I think we're really at the starting phase where, you know, maybe there's a one-off intersection that sort of adheres to the design principles, but it's really inconsistent. And I think one of the important things that we're trying to get across in doing these walks is that these infrastructures are around for 50 years or more. And it's really important that we start building them in a way that makes them the most accessible to the greatest number of people. It has, you know, a lot of different benefits to members in the community about independence and reducing isolation and all those important things that it does. So with these walks, I think we're sort of right at the start of having that conversation with the elected officials. And I think that's one of the reasons that they've been so successful is that the officials themselves know this. And so they're looking for answers and even more questions that they can pose to the engineering department, the planning department, the designers in not only how to do this in their municipality, but how do we do it so that it's right across Canada, I think is a really important issue also.
Absolutely. I spoke with Fraser a couple of days ago, Fraser and Vic, and I think one thing he said to me that really struck me is that a big part of it is that just, you know, in Canada, in the United States, in a lot of North America, the car is king. And in order to make things more accessible and safe for pedestrians, there almost needs to be like this shift in values regarding that.
Certainly, I think everybody has responsibilities, whether you're a pedestrian or whether you're a driver or you're a cyclist or you're a e-mobility device user. It's just the road or the sidewalk is just not yours. And there's a need to have compromise and sharing. And certainly with drivers, I think the really challenging thing that I see, at least, is that people are in such a rush. The idea that you slow down a little bit, or you wait a few seconds to make sure an intersection is clear or that it's safe to turn a corner, it doesn't seem to happen in a lot of situations. People are trying to beat a clock almost, and it's creating really unsafe situations. And that's part of where we see the benefit of designing the intersections properly with accessibility, because that also includes ensuring that you have curb height in places around the curb cutaways, because it's those curb heights that stop drivers from cutting corners. And there's been some horrendous accidents where trucks and vehicles have cut the corners and people have been killed. So I think it's not only designing them in a way that's accessible and inclusive, but you're also designing them in a way that it's defining the roadways to the vehicles. And that includes the cyclists too, that you create the spaces in which they are expected to be. And then, of course, the next really challenging thing is ensuring that people act responsibly and do it in a safe and courteous way.
That was one thing that I think really surprised me during the walk, is that I had never thought about that sort of conflict, especially with bicycles. You know, in that Lower Lonsdale area of North Vancouver, there are so many intersections that have an intersecting bike lane directly in front of the crosswalk. And, you know, while that might be very convenient for bikers, if they're not adhering to the fact that they need to stop at those intersections, that can be really dangerous for people that need to take those crosswalks.
Yeah. And you know, I have teenage boys, and, you know, they ride their bikes around North End. And so I definitely want them to have safe spaces for doing that. But, you know, sometimes in society we get this sort of mentality that it's all or nothing. And I think the bike lanes are fantastic. But this idea that the only way to have a bus stop around a bike lane is that you have seniors using canes and walkers, or people who are blind who are using their hearing to understand what's around them and their mobility devices, or, you know, moms with strollers that, you know, the strollers are pushed out in front of them, you know, 3 feet or more, to have to cross a bike lane to get to the accessible universal transportation that buses are. And it just seems a little counterintuitive. I was speaking with an advocate in Victoria, where they first started having the floating, I call them floating bus stops. Transit prefers them being called island bus stops. But that's where they first had them. And there was actually a human rights tribunal that found them denying equal access. And so the city of Victoria has been looking to how to address this. And one of the things that they've done is where they've had to design new bus stops that would be mid-block that's associated with a bike lane, that rather than having the island separating it all, you have the protected lane up to a certain point, and then you have a point in which the bus can pull in to the bus stop, load and unload, and then continue on, with the requirement for the cyclists, if they want to stay safe, is they would have to come to a stop behind the bus and then proceed once the bus pulls away, which I don't think is an overly onerous expectation.
Also with the floating or the island bus stops, one thing that you pointed out during the walk too is that it's pretty difficult for for blind people to be able to even know that they're there, because like rarely is there any indication when you're walking down the street that all of a sudden you have to stop in the middle of the street and then just take a hard left.
Yeah. Someone I was talking to recommended that whenever these floating bus stops are being designed, or island bus stops, that the engineers and designers and planners have to then access them blindfolded, which I thought would maybe create a greater understanding of our challenges when it comes to us having to do it. But at the same time, I totally get all of the reasons that this makes sense. I mean, if I was a bus driver and I could just stay in a lane and not have to pull in and out, I would think that was a good thing. So I understand that there's safety and efficiencies associated with it. I just don't think that those should trump safety, which apparently is the thinking of today's designers, is that they're willing to err on the side of my safety for efficiencies in moving buses and bicycles. And I find that a little insulting. And I also think of my grandmother, who she was a going concern, and she would do all her shopping on West 10th Avenue in Vancouver, and she had her shopping bag, and I think she had a cart that she would pull around. But she, in her later years, she was somewhat frail. And, what finally did her in was just a simple accident of falling on the street when she got bumped and she broke a hip. And so, I understand that those accidents happen. But at the same time, I think of my grandmother. And, the idea that, today's planners is, well, we're going to bid it up even more. We're just not going to have them worry about, whether the sidewalks are wide enough or how we move people along sidewalks, but we're going to have people move from the sidewalk across a bike lane and then onto another narrow piece of pavement before they can get on the bus. And it just seems a little bit insane to me.
Yeah, I think that really exemplifies too just the importance of these walks, right?
Yeah, I think that's really good. And Councillor Shirari, made the point that when they were designing the floating bus stops, I think he's on the City of North Vancouver Accessibility Committee, and their question to the planners and the engineers is, are you building to a standard? Is this safe? And the answer they got was yes. There's specific standards, and we're building to them. And from what I know, is that there are not standards. There's ways that they are being built, but it seems every planning department has their own sort of artistic flair that they apply to them. But, when the councillor would have asked that question, it would have been prior to, or it would have been at the same time that we were having stakeholder meetings with, the Ministry of Transportation for their active transportation department, TransLink, the different municipality planners, basically with the idea to come up with, if you're having these floating bus stops, one is, should we have them? And the second, if we do have them, how can we minimize the safety issues? And from what I can figure out is we're still in that conversation. And so when engineers and planners are telling the elected officials, oh yeah, we got standards to this. We're following guidelines. They're really not established guidelines or best practices. It's what they've sort of come up with. And, you know, when you hear a lot of the different stakeholders out there from the seniors community, from the other disability groups, the blind community, this is very hard on those people. And, you know, the designers are acting as though standards have been created that sort of solves all that. And it hasn't been. And what I would hope is that the planners, the designers, the engineers have real conversations with elected officials and vice versa. And, you know, not come up with simplistic answers like, oh, yeah, there's standards.
Because, yeah, what good are those standards if they're not being shown?
Well, and I was looking at, the CSA, which is, I'm going to get it wrong, but basically, I think, so the Canadian Standards Association, they came out with a report that basically identified that accessibility guidelines are being set by every level of government. So you have federal, you have provincial, you have municipal. You have, you know, the 100 largest municipalities across Canada, and everybody is creating their own standards. And then the engineers and the designers and the planners are cherry picking those standards. And what we really need is a national standard that addresses the universal design issues and really set out what has to be done, and also set out so that there are real conversations, not only between the engineers, the planners, the designers, and the elected officials, but a really robust engagement with the public about what is being built and what is being suggested. And I think in a lot of cases, you know, that just doesn't happen, and it needs to.
I didn't know that there were standards being made at essentially every level of government. And at what point do standards stop becoming standards, right? If, you know, every level of government that are supposed to be working in tandem with one another have different standards that sort of conflict. Okay. I guess, yeah, I have one more question that I wanted to end off with, which is, you know, if there's anything, you know, with the community walks or with the Walker's Caucus, or just, you know, the response you've gotten from people regarding, you know, more walkable, safer pedestrian infrastructure that gives you hope in all of this.
Well, I think what I have found to be really rewarding out of this is just getting the engagement with the local officials, that they get what you say, and you hear from them and they go, oh, that is a problem. And it's just having that level of buy-in where hopefully the next time that they're having a conversation about design somewhere within the municipality, they can draw on that experience and have those questions, have that ability to ask the questions, which are so important.
Thank you so much for that response. Thank you so much for this interview.
Pleasure.
I think getting your perspective on things was really, really important to me. And I'm very happy about the walk on Saturday and just the work that you and the Walker's Caucus continue to keep doing. So yeah, thank you very much.
Great. Danny, thank you. And thank you for taking the time to ask the questions.
With 1.5 million Canadians identifying as blind or having low vision, what will the future look like as we move to a world where using our eyes for screen time is at an all-time high? The BC Yukon Division of the Canadian Council of the Blind, or CCB, is a group run by the blind for the blind, where sports and recreation, technology training, and peer support are just a few of what they offer. To find out more, visit ccbbcyukon.com.
should have listened when they told us all in school that the boys love the girls. Well, I looked at you, so why don't you tell me I'm pretty like the just friends, the way other girls give out casual compliments, and why don't you kiss me and we can play pretend like you won't break. Where nothing happened, but I know the truth. You told all your friends about the things that we do. And did I really look like I could hurt you? Or did they lie about the color?
Tell Me I'm Pretty by Lila Gray here on Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby, the one and only campus community radio station up here at SFU. You can also find our programs at cjsf.ca, or we have an app that you can use to stream what's going on right now and find out more information about your programs. That's on the App Store or the Google Play Store, depending on your device. I'm Jesse. The first half of the show was Danny's interview with David Brunn, from the Walker's Caucus. And just a good look into accessibility on streets and what it means to be blind navigating the world and the concessions that are made or aren't made and all of those strategies. So thanks to Danny. Thanks to David for that. And the second half of the show is going to be almost entirely my interview with Dr. Jean Pulfus, who, you'll hear more. I introduced the whole thing. So without further ado, we're just going to get into that. And we'll have a little bit of time at the end to just say goodbye. So stick around.
Hi, I'm Jean Pulfus. I'm a senior species at risk biologist for the Canadian Wildlife Service of Environment and Climate Change Canada, and I work on caribou recovery planning.
And yesterday you gave a talk called Indigenous Voices in Conservation, Language as a Foundation for Collaboration in a Caribou Recovery Process, where you talked about the importance and benefits and advantages of incorporating and using Indigenous language and words for caribou and other sort of caribou-related words to help in this recovery strategy. Can you give just like a real broad overview of that work?
Yeah, sure. So we're working on a recovery strategy amendment for Southern Mountain caribou, which are caribou that are found in the southern half of